So I opened the Oxford Companion to Jazz, quite by accident, to a photograph. It's a picture of a 78 record sitting on an old turntable photographed from above, so you see the whole disc and its label head on. It's the original Bluebird recording by Coleman Hawkins of Body and Soul.
Jazz couldn't exist without the phonograph record. In a way, that photo kind of epitomizes an entire era.
Bill Kirshner is a writer, radio host, and jazz scholar who is editor of the Oxford Companion to Jazz.
It's a record that, by common agreement, is one of the great classics of recorded jazz. And at the same time, it was a popular record. The people who knew little or nothing about music other than they liked to listen to it loved that record. It ended up on jukeboxes all over the world. And, you know, you can still find jukeboxes where Hawkins' Body and Soul is played.
So I thought, well, I'd like to know more about Coleman Hawkins. So I turned to the entry on Hawkins, knowing full well there would be an entry on Hawkins, page 177. And I learned something there from Kenny Berger's essay, which was that Hawkins' instrument, the tenor sax, was purely a background instrument at the time Hawkins appeared, almost never used to play solos. Sax solos of the time were played on the alto sax, the soprano sax, or the C melody sax, which disappeared soon after. So I thought, well, there's obviously much more to know about the C melody sax. I jumped to page 597, the entry on saxophones in jazz. That's when I keep seeing the name Frankie Trumbauer mentioned again and again. Trumbauer was a master of the C melody sax.
A very important saxophone player who was the idol of a lot of great players. He was Benny Carter's idol. He was Lester Young's idol. And neither of them probably would have played the way they did had not Frank Trumbauer come along in the 1920s and played what he did on the C melody saxophone.
Dick Spiderbeck and Frank Trumbauer made historic jazz records together.
Like Singing the Blues, for example.
Now, the Oxford Companion has an index of every song mentioned in the text, so I look up Singing the Blues. And on page 617, what do I find? I find this recording with Bix and Trumbauer cited as the first recorded example of the jazz ballad. Imagine that. All the millions of jazz ballads on record, and this is the first. It must have hit listeners like a ton of bricks. I return to the book, which opens to a photo of Mildred Bailey. She's singing. There's a very pronounced shadow behind her and a big old-fashioned NBC microphone above her head. It turns out it's a publicity still of Bailey from the 30s.
I'll be around no matter how you treat me now.
She's just being fully appreciated in the last few years. She died in her late 40s. For many years, her records were unavailable. In her time, she was regarded in the same way as, say, Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. She was that good, but her reputation has gotten a resurgence in recent years.
Your dopey walk, your double talk, I go for that.
Bailey's voice is intoxicating, and as I read more about her, I find her to have been a close friend and colleague of another woman of intoxicating voice, Lee Wiley. Turns out Lee Wiley, much better known than Bailey, was greatly influenced by Bailey's less is more aesthetic. Bailey, further, had a trailblazing association with Paul Whiteman because she was the first so-called girl singer to have a steady gig with a band. After her, every jazz and dance band traveled with a girl singer. The companion entry on girl singers tells us so. But what about the band leader Whiteman? Such a seminal figure, but a controversial one, too. What do they have to say about him? Well, on page 129, Whiteman is referred to as a lively-minded, open-hearted man, an intelligent fan of jazz music.
Whiteman loved jazz musicians. He loved to feature them in his band. He hired Vic Spiderbeck. He hired Frank Trumbauer. He hired Jack Teagarden, Bunny Berrigan, and featured all of them. He was not a, quote, jazz musician, even though some misguided press agent dubbed him the king of jazz, and he got bad rap for years from people who resented him for that. He was like a rock star in the 20s. He had that kind of popularity.
You have to strain to think of a band leader or a jazz player who was like a rock star. In fact, if you go to the index of the Oxford Companion to Jazz, as I did, and look under entertainment, there's a listing, Entertainment, Separation of Jazz From. Turn to page 483, and there's a lengthy consideration of the visible signs that jazz and entertainment were moving in different directions in the 1950s. Performers became more introverted, concentrating on feeling rather than showy technique. Change was in the air, and it lifted jazz to a higher level. It also changed the whole audience for jazz. Which leads me to think, what was the first jazz record anyway? I could go on forever free associating through this book, and probably will. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishko. But wait, here's an entry on jazz in the movies. It says here jazz was almost never heard in movies before the 50s, and then the new seriousness in jazz interacted with the evolution of film scoring in several ways. In contrast to the previous generation of conservatory-trained composers, the new wave of up-and-coming.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.